The views expressed in this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of 94.9 CHRW.
Right, Isis, it is primitive. It's incredible that people can exist like this. At least we won't have to. Not for long. Computer on.
Computer on.
Problem. Earth technology and science has progressed faster than political and social knowledge. Purpose of mission? To prevent Earth civilization from destroying itself before it can mature into a peaceful society.
Incomplete, but sufficient.
Good morning, London. It's Thursday, May 23rd, 2013. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right on CHRW 94.9 FM. Where we'll be with you from now till noon. No, not right wing. Just right.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
519-661-3600, the number you can call if you want to join in on the conversation, or email us at feedback@justrightmedia.org. Well, it's assignment Earth today. Problem. Earth technology and science have progressed faster than political and social knowledge, and the purpose of our mission is to prevent Earth's civilization from destroying itself before it can mature into a peaceful society. Solution? Capitalism and the moral foundation upon which it rests. And that's our theme for the show today. Because, 3 weeks ago, Robert Vaughn and I were privileged to have as our guest on Just Right the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, Dr. Yaron Brook, and you'll be hearing more from him today from some recordings that have nothing to do with us, but sort of were a consequence of our activity. I'd like to note from the outset that the individual most responsible for having brought Yaron Brook, executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, to Canada at the beginning of this month, is a member of both sponsoring groups, the Objectivist Committee, which is based in Toronto, and the Freedom Party of Ontario. His name is Ted Harrelson, and if that name sounds even a little bit familiar to regular listeners of the show, it's because we've heard him on one of our previous sound bites taken from his appearance on the Michael Corrin show, after he spent a bit of time in jail over the Caledonia situation. Don't worry, he was the good guy in that scenario, and we covered it thoroughly on our previous show. Apparently we lock up the good guys these days and leave the bad guys go free. But he's also the fellow that you will see introducing Dr. Yaron Brook on Just Right's newly released YouTube video featuring the presentation Dr. Brook gave at the University of Toronto this past May 6th. So thank you, Ted, for making this all possible. It's an awesome presentation, and watching the YouTube video is just like being there live and getting a front row seat to the event. I know, because that's exactly where I was sitting, and one of the cameras was right beside me. More than half of the presentation is in Q&A format from the audience of just under 200 attendees, and you can check it out at www.justrightmedia.org and just click on the YouTube button and you'll be able to see it for yourself. Recording and producing this video is what has been keeping Robert Vaughn preoccupied lately, although that has nothing to do why he's not co-hosting on today's show. Nevertheless, Robert, an excellent production, and no one watching it will ever be aware of the issues you faced and the work that had to go into producing that thing. So after first talking to each other about what we plan to do on today's Just Right, which is something Robert and I do usually on the Monday before the show, turned out we were both on the same page. We were both thinking about doing a follow-up on Dr. Brook's speaking tour engagement while he was here in Canada. Robert had just completed Just Right's video project, which also, by the way, includes a second exclusive Just Right interview recorded outside on the University of Toronto campus with the skyline of Toronto in the background. And so I'd planned to elaborate on and feature some of the material that he was going to work with. That's what he was planning to do. Now, I had the same idea in mind, but I had already considered approaching the issues I discussed last week, which were about self issues, good, evil, right, wrong, moral, immoral, as elaborated on by Ayn Rand and Objectivists generally. from a differing point of view today, and I was planning to use the non-Just Right sources featuring some of Dr. Brooks' interviews and comments, which I shall return to a little later on. So because we each had so much great material at our fingertips, and because we each wanted to, well, selfishly hog more time to add our own two bits to the conversation, so to make my long story short, Robert and I decided that this week I would go solo on our morality of capitalism theme, while next week Robert will go solo on the same theme, and then we can compare notes later. And in the meantime, we can all share parts of the experience together, while those intrigued enough who want to share the complete experience can do so at their leisure by visiting our website. So, back to our problem as we heard it expressed in our opener today. Earth, this is from an old Star Trek episode, by the way, Gary Seven, it's the season two ender. Earth technology and science, he says, have progressed faster than political and social knowledge. Purpose of mission, to prevent Earth's civilization from destroying itself before it can mature into a peaceful society. Now, I couldn't help but feel, upon hearing the quote-unquote problem stated this way, that it was not only correct in its simple analysis, but that it was addressing the need for, quote, political and social knowledge, to catch up to our level of knowledge regarding technology and science. It's an interesting dilemma. Just why has science and technology advanced so much further than political and social knowledge? The answers, I think, are pretty simple and straightforward. The complexity arises when we try to explain our resistance to these simple truths. To quote Shakespeare, that is the question. Now, technology and science, if you think about it, are based upon disciplining themselves to reality and to reason, which is what accounts for their advancement. But unfortunately, we still haven't applied the principles of self and consent to our political and social knowledge. Reality, reason, self, and consent. These are the objective hierarchical standards matching their four respective philosophical disciplines of metaphysics, epistemology, ethics, and politics. And in that order. Aesthetics is the fifth, of course, but we'll talk about art and TV shows on another episode of Just Right. Now, our Star Trek opener used the terms technology, science, political, social. Four words. Actually, if you matched those Star Trek terms with their philosophically relevant branch of philosophy, here's how they line up. Reality and science, reason, technology, a moral code of self, which leads to social harmony, and the principle of consent, which leads to political harmony. Remember, that's harmony, not agreement. Those are two different things. Now, each of these disciplines requires its previous discipline and leads to the next. That is, if you follow it, you know, reason and technology each depend upon the reality of the science that precede them in the philosophical hierarchy. Without the knowledge of science, you can't build something technologically. And reason and technology both lead to the next link in the chain, self, which is the only entity, by the way, which is capable of reason, which is why it is the self. Groups do not reason. Only their individual members are capable of doing so. An individual cannot reason if he or she is not free to do so, and therefore must operate out of self-interest. If you recall, in a long past episode of Just Right, I featured philosopher John McMurray going on at great length about how the very discipline of science itself is based on our self-interest. There's no such thing as a disinterested science, he asserted. And then, of course, finally, consent is based on the principle of its previous philosophical conclusion, the self. If you have a right to yourself, then the only way to react with other selves is on the principle of consent, which leaves every individual a free agent within the greater social unit of voluntary cooperation. Now, without looking at it, you know, this way at the time, that was exactly the subject we were dealing with on our last week's show, when I compared the libertarian subjectivist, the religious intrinsicist, and the rational objectivist viewpoints on life, death, right, wrong, moral, immoral, good, evil, God, existence, and a whole host of very, I would say, non-economic, organic issues and consequences of the idea of making rational self-interest our social and political moral code. rather than the misunderstood altruism and self-sacrifice code that has become our misguided moral code. So this week I'm going to do something interesting. I'm going to take a look at how the socialist subjectivist expresses his hatred of capitalism while alternating that with audio bites featuring your own book dealing with some common misunderstandings and misconceptions about capitalism. Now, one of the side benefits of bringing someone like your own Brook to speak in Canada is that additional exposure to his objectivist ideas that were offered in other media to whom these ideas might be a little less familiar. When your own Brook visited Canada, in addition to Just Right and in addition to his University of Toronto appearance, he made several other media appearances, including two on Sun TV, one with Ezra Levant and another with Brian Lilly. And these are both great interviews, but they weren't my choice to highlight this week, and there's a reason for that. Instead, I chose an interview done by Hugh Riley and Danielle Kutz on a show called Liquid Lunch, and it can be found on thatchannel.com. I thought we might all get a different insight from hearing questions asked by interviewers who weren't asking the kind of questions you'd get from, say, me and Robert, from a sympathetic rightist viewpoint, or Sun interview viewers, you know, like Brian Lilly or Ezra Levant. So on May 6th, the same day that your own Brooke was to speak at the University of Toronto, they had him on their show, and they called it Save America and the World. Hugh Riley and Daniel Kott speak with Dr. Yaron Brook, executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute and author of The Free Market Revolution, How Ayn Rand's Ideas Can End Big Government. Dr. Brook discusses the morality of capitalism prior to his talk at the University of Toronto, and they suggested perhaps his book should be subtitled How Ayn Rand's Ideas Can Save America. Now, the interviewers went into this interview, I have to admit, in learning mode, shall we say, which set the tone for a great and a very watchable interview. This was well done, and you can see it on thatchannel.com again. The show is called Liquid Lunch, and this was from the May 6th edition of that show, which was the same day that your own Brook appeared at the University of Toronto. Now, their original interview, I have to tell you, was about 44 minutes in length. So even though you're going to hear a lot of it today, you're only hearing a small sampling of the whole thing. Very worth hearing because interesting kind of questions that get asked, not the kind that Robert and I would probably come up with. So here's our first installment of that interview from Liquid Lunch, and when I return, I shall start on my deconstruction of a left-wing point of view of socialism, communism, capitalism, who knows. Back after this.
All right, welcome to Liquid Lunch. We're coming at you live. It's May 6th, and Daniel Kutz is joining me here.
Yes, I'm here, hopefully in body and soul. Nice to see you.
Well, you know, this is why I wanted you to come on the show today, Dan, because I didn't know that you were familiar with some of the work of Ayn Rand.
No, I didn't know, and I did some yoga and did some meditation so I can bring my body and my soul to this interview, hopefully.
Well, because we should get right into it, because we have Dr. Yaron Brook here all the way from Southern California in town to give a talk at the U of T tonight on the morality of capitalism, and of course he has the book here, The Free Market Revolution, How Ayn Rand's Ideas Can End Big Government. So welcome, Dr. Brook. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm really looking forward to this conversation. So, you know, we were sort of talking before the show, and I said that that I thought that Ayn Rand's ideas were partly responsible for the neocon revolution that I guess started around the Margaret Thatcher, Reagan, and Brian Mulroney days. But you're saying my premise is totally wrong.
Well, I'm saying your premise is wrong for many reasons. I don't consider Margaret Thatcher or Ronald Reagan neocons. I mean, again, let's be precise about what we mean by neocons. Yeah, neoconservatives are liberals who became conservative during the late 1960s and early 1970s. The first neocon was Irving Kristol, and he was a Trotskyite. And he was a Trotskyite, then he was an anti-Soviet socialist. And then he moderated a little bit more to the right.
All the way over there.
All the way to becoming a conservative. But he never gave up his liberal, his leftist ideology. He believed that the best way to achieve leftist goals was by adapting government to more conservative means. But he was never, he hated Ayn Rand. He was very antagonistic to Ayn Rand, because Ayn Rand never bought into any of the leftist ideals. I didn't believe that the purpose of society was to attain some kind of leftist utopia. Mm-hmm. She starts with an individual. She has no sense of society and collectivism as a goal, as a, mm-hmm. and the individual as a means to an end. But the neocons believe that individuals are means to ends. The neocons are collectivists. They're statists. They just, you know, they're more conservative than typical leftist statists, but they're still statists. They still want to use government to attain social goals, to attain social means. This is why they have the foreign policy that they do, right? They want to use government to go out into the world and bring democracy to the world. That's not an Ayn Rand perspective. Ayn Rand would never advocate for that. So it's very much they want to make the welfare state more efficient. Mm-hmm. They're not about abolishing the welfare state, which is an Ayn Rand position, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Therefore, using the rich to suck as much tax money out of them in order to redistribute it, so you lower taxes, supply-side economics, right? You lower taxes to get more money out of the rich.
Okay.
Ayn Rand says, no, the money is the rich. You want to lower taxes on them because it's theirs. It's not your money. Don't stop stealing it from them. Yeah. It has nothing to do with these social programs. So the neocons are the enemies of objectivism, and indeed, they view it that way. If you actually talk to a real neocon, you know, the Crystals, Bill Kristol, who's on TV a lot in the United States, or Michael Novak, or Irving Kristol, who died a few years ago, they would have said, we have nothing to do with Ayn Rand.
Okay, so I like the terms you're using, collectivist versus individualist. And it seems that a lot of people are trying to put their finger on what's wrong with America these days. And a lot of them, or the ones that I'm hearing that I like, the ones I listen, they're saying the real problem is collectivism. And it's essentially, I mean, you could call it communism, which is seems a little out of date.
Yeah.
To blame it on communists these days, but they're saying it's this collectivism that's the real problem. But there, it seems people are having a hard time really articulating that, getting that idea across, and coming up with a real solution.
See, there are lots of forms of collectivism. Communism is one. It's a radical form of of socialism, but it's just one form of collectivism. Fascism is a form of collectivism. Multiculturalism, in my view, is a form of collectivism. Any kind of racism is a form of collectivism. Anytime you place the group ahead of the individual, anytime your standard is the group, your standard is society, your standard is something other than the well-being of the individual, then it's a form of collectivism. And again, we have lots of forms of collectivism, only one true form of individualism.
Just from either one of you, actually, my own nose here. What is collectivism? Let's get that started.
Collectivism is the idea that the group is primary.
That the
individual serves the group. That the purpose of your life is to serve your tribe, or your group, or your some collective out there. The state. Any kind of statism, where the state is primary. John McCain say country first, right?
Yeah.
That's collectivism. That's the country first. You're nothing. You're just a cog in the machine to serve serve the state.
No, he's a Republican senator.
Well, Republicans are just as collectivist as Democrats.
Because you just said fascism also. Okay. So
I think just to be clear, I think
but
the left is the primary fascist movement today in the world. Uh-huh. And if the left is far more collectivistic than the right. Now the right has problems. I just mentioned one in McCain, but fascism is not right versus left. What's the difference between fascism and communism? Well, what's the difference? They're both the same.
I'm not sure. Private corporations.
So the difference is this. The difference is that the communism, the state owns the means of production, right? It owns the factories.
Right, okay.
In fascism, the state controls the means of production. They leave you the pretense of private property. Mm-hmm. You own it, but they control it. So under Mussolini or Hitler, did anybody really own their own factories? Could they decide what price to charge and what products to make? No. The state told them, but they pretended like they were private. But the fundamental for both is that you as an individual don't matter. you as an individual live for the proletarian under communism, you live for the state under fascism, or for the race under fascism, or for some other, you know, statist goal. But there's no difference between the two. The two are both, ultimately, on the left side of the spectrum. They're both big government welfare. It's no accident that the Nazi Party was the National Socialist Party. They were socialists. They believe in, you know, sacrificing the able, the wealthy, the people who create stuff for the rest of the people, for everybody else. Massive redistribution of wealth, control over the means of production. So there's fundamentally no difference between fascism and communism, and they both belong on the left side of the political spectrum.
That was Yaron Brook speaking to Hugh Riley and Danielle Katz on their show Liquid Lunch that aired on May 6th of this month. Going to head into my, and we'll hear more from them a little later on in the show as well. I want to enter a deconstruction phase, I guess. Last week I said, well, I'm going to be totally selfish and hog the show. Today I'm going to be altruistic and share my suffering with you. I want to share the experience of what it's like for me to read what passes for political commentary these days. You know, I used to remember that joke, what's black and white and red all over? And the answer was a newspaper, ha ha ha, because it's supposed to be R-E-A-D. Well, no, now it's just red, R-E-D, the way things are being written nowadays. There are many publications that I get to pick up around here at the University of Western Ontario, which is a location from which Just Right broadcasts. And one of those publications, the magazine I've seen sitting around called Open Wide, it's a very... It's a slick magazine, nice looking, and it has an interesting disclaimer on the cover that sounds a little familiar. Quote, the contents of this publication do not reflect the opinions of the University Students' Council or the University of Western Ontario. The USC assumes no responsibility or liability for any error, inaccuracy, omission, or comment contained in this publication, or for any use that may be made of such information by the reader. So I guess pointing out any errors, inaccuracies, or omissions is up to somebody else, which I suppose is the whole point of having free speech. And there's an article in it that got my attention, and it's my intention here now to read it from end to end between now and the end of the show, but whether I'm going to be capable of doing that or not, it depends on time and how much of a bit of a rant I get going here. And the article was called How We Left the Left and Why the Right's Not Right, The Media's New Political Spectrum. And it was written by one of the magazine's staff writers, Kevin Chow, who offers us what he called, quote, a quick glimpse into the structure of the political spectrum. And I have to tell you from the outset, too, that there was a time in my life when this might have been the way I interpreted politics. Certainly when I was in my early 20s, there wasn't too much in this that I might have been able to counter or say anything about. So it's just amazing how almost every sentence in this essay is something in it that I can, you know, correct or change or disagree with. And he starts off by saying, very simply put, the political spectrum has left and right wings with opposing ideas on how much government control is necessary to run the country. Well, that might have been the original theory, but very simply unput for today, there is no political spectrum separating the left wing from the right wing. Politically, the so-called left wing and right wing are opposites in the struggle for power only, for political power only. They are not opponents in any other sense of the word. They're all on the same page in every other respect. Opposing ideas? Don't even make me laugh, or is it cry, I don't know. Their ideas are all on the collectivist page, which means socialism, communism, fascism, ideas which are equally shared by all of the parties in our legislature and parliament, left-wing and right-wing alike. However, here's how the author sees that spectrum. To continue, quote, the far left believes that a large government with many regulations will ensure the safety, prosperity, and equality of the people. The far right believes in equal rights and individual autonomy without government intervention and that the free market can meet all of our needs and interests. The center believes that the free market and individuality are important, but that some government regulations are necessary to keep society running smoothly. In contemporary American politics, and by the way, most of this was written from an American point of view with a few Canadian interjections. From left to right, we have socialism, liberalism, conservatism, and libertarianism. Canadian political parties are aptly named: Conservative, Liberal, and NDP, Social Democrats. In the U.S., the right-wing Conservatives are Republicans and the left-wing Liberals are Democrats. So how come, he asks, the news confuses viewers with sweeping generalization and focuses on personalities instead of policy? Why can't our politicians just sit down in front of the camera and have a rational discussion about what the government can and cannot do effectively? Well, that's a good question. But first of all, I notice he's always talking about viewers and sitting in front of the camera. He's not talking about listeners or readers, so he must think the only place we get our news from is from television. And obviously this writer wants 3-second TV answers only. Why doesn't he try listening to, like, this show or maybe reading something? I don't know. But what's his answer to the question? Quote, because regular politics doesn't make good TV. Back to the TV set again. Well, you know, regular politics is left, real. That involves rational discussion mentioned. Real politics is right and does make good TV, but nobody's airing it. And most of the media are also left, whether left or right wing. So the media had to change politics, he writes. Well, I have to say this to that. First of all, the establishment media is the voice of politics. They don't, you know, do this, that, or the other thing. They are the voice of politics. Newspapers have always been the voice of a particular political interest or party, for example. Broadcast media is no different. And at the end of the day, he who pays the piper determines the philosophy of the media in question. It's not always about direct economic or ownership issues. It's about the shared philosophy that seemingly automatically unites people who share a fundamental view of reality. The politics is an entirely, you know, it's a consequence of that shared philosophy. So why doesn't the media focus on policy, as he asks? Well, it's simple. Tell me what Tim Hudak's policy is on anything. Really. Even Tim Hudak himself hasn't been able to tell us, with media opportunities going all the way back to the days when we were still asking, Hudak? Who's that? Whose name's Hudak? I mean, we still don't have a clue. 214 pages in his Paths to Prosperity, and not one thing about balancing the budget. Freedom Party did it in 12 pages. Now, here's the real target of the author's complaint. As always, 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 by socialists of every color of the spectrum that, you know, they would all like us to believe, exists, but which doesn't exist, and that's capitalism. Like, what else would it be? That nasty old capitalism keeps polarizing the issue. The nasty old capitalism says thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's anything, is an obvious direct polar opposite of every one of the other wings of the spectrum who all believe the opposite of that, if not in words, certainly in deed. But here's what he writes, quote, in free market capitalism, media corporations have to make a profit to survive. Private broadcasters manipulate their content in order to attract higher viewership, read increased profits. These techniques mostly involve sensationalizing media as well as simplifying entire events into 4-second clips. These sensational sound bites polarize political ideologies in order to make it easy for viewers who are guaranteed to be amused when the news is constructed to be entertaining. Commentary and entertainment media characterize entire demographics. No, Hollywood, not every Russian from the 90s was a terrorist intent on destroying capitalism. And no, Stephen Colbert, you can't write off half of your country's political views with a crude joke. By depicting politics in binaries, the media polarize each and every topic. Now, end quote. That's exactly what any rational being has to do in order to make a choice. I mean, the mere concept of having a choice implies that there's two of something or even more than two of something. And any rights to keep the news interesting, broadcasters focus on wedge issues, that is, a specific issue that the two parties cannot agree on, even though there are larger issues at hand and on which they all agree. Now, I have to ask, why would anyone focus on the issues where they agree on everything if the whole point is to get you to make a choice between them? How do you make a choice between two things that are exactly the same? The answer is you don't. You can't make that choice. You look for the differences to make it possible to make a choice. Not to make the news interesting, even though that may be a consequence of doing something, you know, rational. But this is how the whole effort goes along. This is just an incredible view, really, of a left-winger. I'm going to continue this whole discussion a little later, but first we're going to continue with our Hugh Riley and Danielle Cutts conversation with Dr. Yaron Brook from their show Liquid Lunch, which was aired on May 6th. We'll be back after this.
Let me rephrase the question.
Yes.
By following all that you said, which is the Ayn Rand model and work and so on, does somehow, even while following this mandate, does it somehow indirectly help community that I'm wondering somehow?
Absolutely. It helps everybody. Everybody benefits from this. And again, you know, Adam Smith understood this, right? Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, in 1776, he wrote the book. He says, the baker doesn't bake the bread because he likes you. He doesn't care about you one iota. He's baking the bread because he's trying to make a living. Mm-hmm. And the grocer who sells you the bread doesn't care about you. He's trying to make a living. But you know what? You're better off. And everybody would be better off because the baker bakes the bread. So by people pursuing their own self-interest, not sacrificing, everybody who's willing to work, everybody who's willing to take responsibility over their own life, everybody who's willing to be rational and to pursue their own rational values is better off. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of society that, you know, I believe in. That's the kind of society the book is driving towards. That's the kind of society Ayn Rand's driving towards. And to do that, you have to get government out of our lives. Out of our lives in every aspect. Out of our bedrooms, out of our boardrooms, out of our shops, out of our banks, out of every interaction that we have, because they distort that interaction. But to do that, we have to first reject 2,000 years of religion and philosophy. Reject the idea that your life doesn't belong to you. Reject the idea that that nobility and virtue are sacrifice and giving. And I say nobility and virtue are building, creating, trading, that's what nobility and virtue. I say Bill Gates is a saint for building Microsoft. The fact that he gives his money away afterwards, fine, who cares? And he and not only that, but Bill Gates will do more good for individuals out there in the world through building Microsoft than he ever will through his philanthropy. Mm-hmm. And yet, we live in a society that views his philanthropy as good and building Microsoft as evil. That's why we're in the mess we're in. That's why we're going to get into a bigger mess in the future. We've only just started our mess because we're heading to, you know, the society resents individualism. Society resents this idea of self-interest, and therefore it resents and rejects capitalism. And that's what we're seeing in America today. That's what we're seeing in Europe today. That's what we're seeing all over the world.
Listen, you know I didn't take it. Now, how could I carry out $1 million?
Those security bonds, 10 stinking pieces of paper. You could have put them anywhere while I was out of the vault.
Security bonds. Brilliant, Dad.
Those are good in Canada, aren't they, Al?
Listen, Al. Monday, when they check the duty roster, one word is going to come down from above. Rhodes. And I will have one word for them. Bundy.
Listen, Steve, I didn't take it.
Al! We're talking 20 to 50 with chainsaw killers. And don't think I'm serving time alone, Bunky. If I'm going to be playing in the showers with maniacs, you're going to be passing the soap.
I did not take it.
Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go home, drink moderately, and pass out. And when I come to, you're going to give the money back. Because I believe deep down that you are an honest man. So. There I go, walking through the door to leave you alone with your conscience. Peggy, I'm depending on you to make him do the right thing.
Steve, if Al said he didn't take it, he didn't take it. God, I love you. Sure, my husband shows me no affection and has a go-nowhere job. But Daddy is really taking care of his family now, kids. My dad!
Peg, listen to me for once in your life. I don't have the money.
Now, don't think you're holding out on me, Al. Uh-uh. I've made your breakfasts. I've had your children. I've even gone to the bathroom after you. I've paid my dues, Al. I've earned that money just as if I'd taken it myself. Half of it's mine. Unless you go to prison, and then it's all mine.
You know, the humor in Mrs. Bundy's totally immoral claim on wealth is kind of self-evident. She knows it's not hers, And it's making a moral equivalence, you know, of earning and taking, neither of which go together. Even after she admits to the illegality of Al's action, that only increases her sense of entitlement. And, you know, that could be any socialist talking or any citizen and taxpayer who feels the same way about their government finance benefits. We don't care that all our politicians are involved in scandals and doing all the stealing for us, just as long as we get our benefits. And that's kind of where we are today. Now, back to my little deconstruction of this article that appeared in Open Wide, which seems very preoccupied with the idea of polarizing politics in general and polarizing issue, which is, of course, the very first thing I recall reading from Ayn Rand. She says that's the first thing you got to do to make a choice is you got to polarize things. But that's not how the writer here feels about it. And he writes, quote, so what has changed with the right? He says, as the Republican Party gradually adopted the Christian vote, the media sensationalist focus polarized the two political parties, and there's that polarization issue again. Christian objectives, such as criminalizing contraceptives, began to take form in the Republican platform. The demographic that used to be part of the silent majority burst onto the TV screens in the form of radical personalities like Sarah Palin or Todd Akin. I don't know what I consider Sarah Palin a radical, but then he writes, by privileging each party's most extreme ideological positions on high-profile wedge issues, instead of looking for aspects on which both parties converge, the media have helped shape the Republicans' agenda of increased militarization and Christian ideals. Of course, caricaturing ideologies has left the left in shambles, too. It is now impossible for any American politician to discuss anything left of moderate conservatism without a public outcry. For instance, Fox News once declared Obama a socialist for supporting Medicare, despite the fact that nearly every developed country has universal health care, end quote. Well, Medicare is a socialist plan. It's ownership and or control of people's choices and of the healthcare system. Every developed country is predominantly socialist, especially when it comes to healthcare, which is why they're all on the brink of bankruptcy, a fiscal bankruptcy that's the consequence of the moral bankruptcy on which they operate that system. And it's not that you couldn't have a healthcare system that would protect you from terrible financial losses and make it work. There are capitalist versions available, but nobody wants the capitalist version. They want the socialist version. And so the writer writes, though Clinton and Obama represent the American left, the Democratic Party's policies have shifted so far right, I don't know what he's talking about, that Noam Chomsky claimed that the Republican president, Richard Nixon, was the last liberal president nearly 40 years ago. Well, there might be some truth to that. And he writes, before World War I broke out, the Socialist Party of America had 6% of the popular vote. After two world wars, however, America became so threatened by the communist Soviet Union that they started the Cold War. In order to remove any communist sympathies from the American public, and then he gets into the whole U.S. government house un-American activities. You've heard about all that. And he says, since then we've been taught by blockbuster films over and over again that socialism is a dirty word. You know, I wish that were true, because socialism is a dirty word because it represents an immoral relationship between government and its citizens, by depriving them of their individual autonomy and choice, to the extent that it's socialist. That's the socialist aspect. And I'm sorry, but blockbuster films do not teach that socialism is a dirty word, but that capitalism and business are dirty words. I mean, when we ask Yaron Brook about the positive movies on business and capitalism, we could only think of one, and that was Other People's Money, and we had a bit of a disagreement about that, too. So I don't know where all these, pro-capitalist movies are. I wish he would have given us an example of one on any side of anything. And then he writes, and how many action flicks are the villains Russian? I haven't seen any in a long time. Don't know what he's watching. How many times have we been told by the movies that socialists support terrible dictatorships that hate their citizens, end quote. Well, it's not the movies that are telling us that. Reality tells us that. Socialists do support dictatorships. That's what socialism is. Collective ownership and or control. It's dictator. They dictate everything from behavior to prices. Hello? Dictionary call. Last call for a dictionary. Jeez. And he writes, while Stalinism was obviously horrifying, I don't know why he thinks that, because why should he think that since he accepts everything that led up to it? The media has shaped our perspective of the political spectrum to believe that anything left of liberalism indicates a totalitarian dystopia. For instance, the socialist president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, who, like any politician, had supporters and detractors, was able to claim some pretty impressive triumphs, such as lowering unemployment by 10% and reducing extreme poverty from 23% to 8%, blah, blah, blah. I don't know how anybody can support a monster like Hugo Chavez. I mean, if you want to see just how evil a person that guy was, and to say just because he's done one thing good that excuses all the murders and everything else he's done, it's just a moral chasm that I just can't cross it. I don't know how anybody can write this kind of stuff. And then he writes, but these achievements do not fit with American media's portrayal of the political spectrum. I don't know what that's got to do with it. And Chavez's progressive accomplishments went largely unnoticed. Many believe he was a dictator instead of democratically elected, and we still equate socialism with poisonous authority. Well, most socialists are democratically elected, whatever that nature of their democracy is. Hitler was democratically elected the same way, if you want to go to that point. Then here's a killer. He writes, though I do not mean to defend socialism as a practice itself. Well, I can't even get through that. Of course you're defending socialism as a practice. You're lying either to me or to yourself. That statement's completely inconsistent with and contrary to everything else written in this same essay. Then he says, I do believe that its meaning, though it doesn't say what the meaning is, he never does, is consistently misconstrued by the media. Just as the media prefer to link the political right with heavy militarization and radical Christian ideals. The difference is the right has followed the media's prompting, whereas the far left of American politics has all but disappeared. Well, I guess when you're in the forest, you can't see the trees anymore. The far left hasn't disappeared. It's filled the entire so-called political spectrum, from left to right wing. It's all left. There is no spectrum there. It's just all one color, that big red color, and you get your choice of red. And that's the spectrum he wants us to choose from, of course, which is why he doesn't want us to even know that there are other choices out there. So then he says, so the media has changed our perception of politics. Now what? For starters, think critically about the news sources you use and the picture they intend to paint. If you still plan to rely on mainstream networks for your news, at least remember to take everything with a grain of salt. Which I suppose is a roundabout way of saying, you know, don't believe in anything, be a perpetual skeptic. You know, nobody's telling the truth, go for the compromise. Then he says, the media would rather you believe that politics is a war than a spectrum. And that is his essential conclusion of his article. So the author, when it comes to politics, you know, we have only two, and only two, count them, polarized opinions and viewpoints, war or spectrum. And the correct option is spectrum. I don't know about you, but to me that's totally meaningless in the sense that the conclusion is useless in the process of choosing anything, especially between left, tyranny, and right, freedom. A spectrum of tyrannies is still one option. There's not a right option. Politics deals with the process of electing representatives who are elected to govern by making policy that the government must adhere to. You know, politics was meant to replace war and internal assassinations and power coups. Politics is about what the acceptable use of force in a society is. And all ideologies of the left have no limits on what is considered acceptable. So, you know, in war, the victor always confiscated the wealth of the conquered. In the leftist politics, one step removed from war itself, the majority loot the minority by means of legislation. As the politics moves further and further toward the right, the true right, not the left-right, politics itself becomes more civilized, as the initiation of force by the state against its citizens becomes to be seen for the true evil it is. Life, liberty, and property are always destroyed under the infinite ideologies of the left. Life, liberty, and property are always the ideals that the true right works to protect and defend. It's not polarized because of the media. It's polarized because these two views of the role of government, one to dictate and rule and the other to actually govern, are as polar opposites of each other as it gets. When Wide Open complains about the media being the source of the polarization, it's just too silly, I mean, to even respond to. What they object to is anyone's pointing out the reality of the situation. It's reality that is the source of the polarization, and it's the evasion of reality that is the source of the left ideology. Reality demands that polarized views be exposed, not hidden and disguised as Wide Open would suggest. Totally Closed should be the name of this magazine. So what conclusions can you possibly draw from someone telling you that, you know, politics is a spectrum rather than a war? So, you know, thanks for letting us know there are no clear sides when we're asked to make a political choice, and thanks for making it clear that you don't want to know about the clear sides that actually distinguish one from another so we can choose rationally. I mean, look at it. Ideologically and pragmatically, here's what you get from Democrats in the States. You get socialism, that's the left wing of the left. You get the Republicans, you get socialism, that's the right wing of the left. Here in Canada, you have the New Democrats, you get socialism, the left wing of the left. You have liberals, you get socialism, another left wing of the left. You have the progressive conservatives, progressive means socialism, by the way. So you get socialism, the middle wing of the left, and you get conservatives federally. And there you get socialism, the right wing of the left. Yep, there's the political spectrum for you, such as it exists today. And I'm not saying this to be funny or just to make jokes. You can see it by the direction that government's moving. Have you ever, ever, ever in your life remembered taxes to go down, your freedoms to increase, business to improve on a general basis? It's not happening. It's going in the other direction. And, you know, it's the same in Canada, the U.S., all around the world. Every shade of red that you can imagine. But remember, that's only the political spectrum. On the ideological spectrum, red turns to gray because it makes no distinctions between right and wrong. Power is the only objective in gray politics. There's nothing else at stake but power when the issues are not polarized. I mean, what else is there left? I mean, pardon the pun, because it's all left, when everybody's on the same page. But isn't it yet another example from nature, you know, that in order for power as we know it to be generated, like in electricity, we actually require two polarized opposites in the flow of energy to do it. We refer to these as the positive and negative poles, both in the charge and in the magnets that create the fields necessary to generate the change. Polar opposites, necessary to get the work done in physics and in power. In politics, left and right, absolutely necessary. Otherwise, you cannot make a choice. Take our final break. Back to Liquid Lunch and more from your own Brooke.
So, we don't have a lot of time left, but this is a fascinating discussion and certainly blowing some people's minds, sure opening them up to ways that maybe they never really thought about things before. But let's talk about some of the other solutions that, that you've got in your book here and that presumably you're going to be talking about tonight at the U of T.
Well, part of the case I make in the book is that capitalism works. It's unequivocal. If you look at the historical evidence, if you look at across cultures, if you're talking about creating wealth, creating a higher standard of living, if you're talking about how well the poor do, there is no system in human history that comes even close to capitalism. Every country that approaches a more capitalist system does better than countries that approach a more collectivized system, a more statist system, socialism, fascism, whatever. That is just empirical fact. Anybody with eyes should be able to see that. Look at Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. You know, 7.5 million people live on this rock. No natural resources, nothing there. 70 years ago, it was a fishing village. All they have is the protection of property rights. And yet it's thrived. And you'd rather be in Hong Kong than any of the other Asian countries around there. That's why people are willing to go on rafts and row to try to get to Hong Kong. That's why if they opened the borders, there'd be a flood of millions more people into that place. So capitalism works. And so the question we ask in the book, and this is a question to everybody out there, you know, to me it's self-evident. All you need to do is know history and you know capitalism works. Why do people hate it? Because they do. 90%, 90+% of people hate capitalism. Particularly in its pure form. Most people think it's a disaster. Most people think all they can think of when they think of capitalism is bad stuff that they learned at school about it. There's nothing positive associated with it. And what my claim is that the problem with capitalism is not economic. The economics are clear cut. They're simple. All these economists who claim capitalism doesn't work just don't know what they're talking about. They're lying through their teeth. Paul Krugman's a liar. He's a bad economist and a liar.
Paul Krugman?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, he's always on CNN.
Yeah, I mean, he's what he says is just plain false, and he knows it.
He just put a book out, actually.
Yeah, he puts lots of books out. Yeah. He won the Nobel Prize for Economics. That's how bad of an economist he is. The problem is that people perceive capitalism as unethical, as immoral, as unjust. It's the ethical beliefs that drive the perception of economics. It's not about economics, it's not about facts, it's not about politics, it's about morality. Because when we grow up, from when we're this big, we are taught a particular type of morality. What is good? What is noble? What is virtuous? What does our mother tell us is good and noble and virtuous? Putting the interest of others first. Being selfless. Sacrifice. Sacrifice is the greatest virtue of all, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, what's capitalism about? It's about self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
It's about making money for whom? For you. It's about producing goods for whom? For you. It's about consuming goods for whom? For you. So you've got capitalism that is self-interested, and morality that says self-interest is evil. And indeed, what's good is sharing. What's good is sacrifice. What's good is giving to people.
Right.
You know, see, take Bill Gates. Bill Gates built a wonderful company called Microsoft that touches every human being on the planet, makes all our lives better. And yet he gets zero moral credit for that. When does Bill Gates become a good guy? When he sets up a philanthropy and starts giving it away. And how would he become a saint? If he gave all his money away and moved into a tent, and if he could bleed a little bit and show a little bit of suffering on the way, then he would become a bigger saint, right? Because saints are sufferers, people who suffer. That's our standard of morality.
So
now, that's inconsistent with capitalism. That's consistent with socialism. Socialism demands sacrifice. You produce, don't keep it. You have to give it to Joe.
Okay, so I'm waiting for the punchline, because that's not the case here. Because obviously you're very conscientious
no,
when you're talking about capitalism.
My case is that self-interest is virtuous, that there's absolutely no reason to sacrifice for other people, that selflessness is evil, that it's wrong to be selfless, that it's wrong to sacrifice, that it's wrong to live for other people. You should live for yourself. You should live for your life. You've got one life here. Why should you live it for other people?
Okay, so
why do they have a right to your life that's greater than your life, right to your own life?
But do you find that's a hard sell?
Not when explained properly.
Okay.
Yes, it is when people say, selfish, ooh, because I've got 2,000 years of philosophy and religion teaching people that thinking about yourself and pursuing your own values and doing what's good for you is evil and wrong, and you should be sacrificing to the state, to God, to your neighbor, to the poor, to somebody else, that your life is meaningless. And yet people try to live both ways. They try to do what's good for themselves, and then they do some community service in the evening to make themselves feel good. But I'm saying, what do you need to do the community service to make yourself feel good? As long as you're taking care of yourself, as long as you're doing it in a way that is not hurting other people, that is hurting other people through force. You're not defrauding them, you're not lying them, you're not cheating, you're not sacrificing them to you. You're not abusing them. Then why do you have to be? You should be proud of your achievements. You should be proud of your own life. You should pursue your own beliefs. That's the story of Howard Roark in the Fountainhead. He's building those buildings for himself because his vision of what is good, his ideals of what is good. He's not doing it for the community. He's not doing it for other people. He's doing it for his clients and for himself, for that contractual relationship. And who loses when he does that? When I live for myself, who loses? Everybody gains. The client gains because they got a beautiful building. Mm-hmm. People in the community gain because they can look and see a beautiful building. Who loses? Nobody loses. It's a win-win. The whole beauty of capitalism, the whole beauty of self-interest is they are win-win relationships. We don't do this interview unless I'm benefiting from it and you're benefiting from it. If you're not benefiting from it, you shouldn't do this interview. Please don't do it as a sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right. Just right. You know, Dr. Brook has taken on a rather daunting challenge in what he's saying and how he's doing it. Unlike most philosophers or economists we hear from, Dr. Brook wears both hats, that of the economist and that of the philosopher. When the economist takes a look at capitalism, he considers the material gain, focusing on business, banks, and interest accruing. But when the philosopher takes a look at capitalism, he considers the spiritual, personal, and social gain, not from financial interest accruing, but from self-interest accruing, as the social norm and the moral standard, and of the direct relationship between the latter to the former. So, you know, this, when these two fellas interviewing him were talking to him, they got the idea that he was really being altruistic and that what he was saying wasn't really that much different from being altruism because he's just sort of, you know, being semantic. But that's not the case. I have to be reminded here of the importance of this distinction. It's not to tell people that they're being bad when they're being charitable. That's not the issue. In her introduction to her book, The Virtue of Selfishness, you know, one of the first things I ever read by Ayn Rand, she wrote, quote, "The title of this book may evoke the kind of question that I often hear once in a while. Why do you use the word selfishness to denote virtuous qualities of character when you know that word antagonizes so many people to whom it doesn't mean the things you mean?" And she says, well, it's not a semantic issue or a matter of arbitrary choice. The meaning ascribed in popular usage to the word selfishness is not merely wrong. It represents a devastating intellectual package deal which is responsible more than any other single factor for the arrested moral development of mankind, she writes. Altruism declares that any action taken for the benefit of others is good and that any action for your own benefit is evil. Therefore, the beneficiary of the action is the only criterion of the morality. As long as the beneficiary is somebody other than you, well, then anything goes. And she concludes, hence, the appalling immorality, the chronic injustice, the grotesque double standards, and insoluble conflicts and contradictions that have characterized human relationships and human societies throughout history, all under the variance of altruist ethics. Which brings us back to where we started our show today. Star Trek, Assignment Earth. Earth technology and science have progressed faster than political and social knowledge. Well, that's because our political and social knowledge fell victim to the arrested moral development of mankind. If we suddenly started treating science and technology the same way we approach social and political issues, they too would cease to progress and fall victim to the same arrested moral development. You don't really want the morally arrested Attila and the witch doctor having control over the products of science and technology. Because instead of building nuclear power plants, they build nuclear bombs. It's a recipe for self-destruction. So if the purpose of our mission today was to prevent Earth civilization from destroying itself before it can mature into a peaceful society, the solution is capitalism and the moral foundation upon which it rests. My time's up, so be sure to join us again next week when we continue our journey in the right direction. Until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Hi, Al. Be right with you.
Yeah, I've never been in a bank that was closed before.
Yep, this is where it all happens. You know, this is my favorite time and my favorite place. Yeah, some people like Hawaii at sunset. Me, give me a bank after hours. It's the cathedral of capitalism. Can you hear it, Al? It's the sound of interest accruing.